Bonjour et bienvenue à l'épisode 151 du podcast Innovation, Agilité et Excellence. Mon nom est Jean-François Dantel et en compagnie d'Éric Lheureux, nous désirons vous offrir réflexions, conseils et perspectives afin de faire face aux perturbations du marché et pour développer la croissance profitable de votre organisation. Dans notre épisode d'aujourd'hui, je discute culture d'entreprise et capitalisme à la nord-américaine avec le professeur Stephen Blank. Vous le savez, nous aimons aller questionner le professeur Blank sur des sujets pointus. Cette fois-ci, c'est sur le changement de culture chez Boeing qui mène à cette série de problèmes qui font la manchette ces dernières années. Et, comme d'habitude, il nous donne une leçon en pensée stratégique et nous rappelle que pour comprendre le présent, il faut connaître le passé et les changements qui sont survenus et qui continuent de survenir. Le professeur Stephen Blank est un habitué de nos podcasts et il vit et travaille à New York. Il détient un baccalauréat de l'Université Dartmouth, des maîtrises des universités de Cambridge et de Harvard, ainsi qu'un PhD de Harvard. Il est Senior Fellow de l'Institut sur la science, la recherche et les politiques publiques de l'Université d'Ottawa et Senior Fellow de l'Institut McDonald Laurier. Vous trouverez un résumé de sa longue et passionnante carrière à l'épisode 25, le premier des 5 épisodes faits avec lui. Bonne écoute. Professor Blank, what a tremendous pleasure to have you back on this podcast.
I'm delighted, as always, to be here with my favorite student.
In a recent opinion piece by Bill Saporito in the New York Times entitled, Boeing Made a Change to Its Corporate Culture Decades Ago, Now It's Paying the Price, caught my attention. We've all heard about the problems Boeing has had with the 737 MAX, problems to which Boeing commercial aircraft had until recently been relatively immune to. My first question to you is, what is this corporate culture? I'd like to hear you talk about corporate culture.
Okay, culture here is an odd sort of subject. It could be anything you really want, how people behave, how they think. There was a time when I worked for big companies as a consultant, and I was working for 8 different major multinationals, and I could tell you after the first 5 minutes which company any person I met worked for. There's a way they looked, the way they dressed, the way they talked. I mean, that sense, deeply ingrained corporate culture. And that really has changed. But one of the reasons it has changed, or the most powerful reason it's changed, is changes really in the whole structure of firms. I mean, we really, if you want to talk about changes in corporate culture, you have to go under the skin, into the bones. And that, if you'll let me, those are two things I can talk about very quickly that really relate. Why is culture change? It's changed because the nature of the goddamn firm has changed. And it's changed one big reason, because of what we call financialization. We can talk about this. This very much is a factor of the deregulation of financial markets in the 1980s. Until then, money was tight. Lending, borrowing was difficult. Issuing shares was difficult. There wasn't a lot of money around. Mm-hmm. With the deregulation of financial markets, it made everything very different. And one of the things that changed corporate culture everywhere, not just in the industry, was that one increasingly was judged, companies, leaders, on shorter-term financial metrics. Jack Welch is, of course, the proponent of all this. Jack Welch is no longer a hero now as we look back on this, but he certainly was then, that the Welch view was that quarterly returns were the critical indicator of success. And of course, we learned that really wasn't necessarily so. It was fairly easy to influence quarterly returns. Hell, you could fire people or hire people. You could divest or invest, and whatever it did would kick up for the quarter. But this became increasingly, and then this has two enormous effects. One, it changes corporate structure. The big firms that we knew about after World War II, mm-hmm. with multiple entities, mm-hmm. realized they had to be smaller. So you have this divesting. You go from the Ford model of deep integration all in one place to this deintegration. Now, that's facilitated because of changes in transportation, changes in communication. You could actually run things from a distance. You could place things where they were economically more viable and still assume they could to just-in-time logistics, communication, that you would get what you want on time. And that would, you could lower your prices. And for many industries, you could cut down the number of employees.
Yes.
In the United States, if you cut down the number of employees, you sell some, you're not, the next person is not responsible for the pensions and stuff. So you shrink the size of the firm by outsourcing on the assumption everything can still work Jiminy Cricket, but can be fine and cheaper. And so what you're really looking for increasingly to cut costs by doing a variety of things, because cutting costs means better profit ratios, and that's what we're now running on. So now there's a sidebar here, is that it's also the outsourcing is very much a function of the airplane industry. Because if you want South Korea to buy your airplane, you're going to have to make stuff. That intensifies this de-integration. So that's a huge issue, and it affects all firms, not just in the aircraft industry, but all firms. That the metric is much less longer term production market goals and shorter term financial goals, and that certainly affects corporate careers.
And we used to call this, Professor Blank, if you remember, we used to call this concentrating on your core competencies or focusing on core competencies and outsourcing whatever was not in your core competencies or your sphere of investment. But I never saw the link between core competencies and culture. Where is that link?
Well, again, you got two things going on here at once. One is core competencies in a materials things you can touch way, but also core competence in a Jack Welch way, which is improving your quarterly return.
Okay.
Those two things are not always the same. One can assume they are the same. You can believe fairy tales and dragons and hobgoblins and all those nice things. You can assume they're the same, but they're not necessarily the same. And so throughout much of the Welchian era, it was assumed that at the end of the day, the two core competencies lined up with each other. Mm-hmm. That what you did best was also what you're going to make the most money from. Again, you have to believe in fairies to believe in that. And for many of us in the industries, core competence and getting rid of the stuff that you didn't quite need was a mantra. But always in back of that, upstairs, were the guys who are looking at quarterly return. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you got to get these two things orbiting around each other with a good belief that somehow they're the same or they make each other better, but da-da-da-da.
Yes.
Always so. And the other thing is, of course, how corporate careers. There was a day when people stayed with the company for long hours. I said, when I worked with IBM, everyone that I worked with at this level that had been in IBM for a very long time. You assumed when you left college, as I did in 1961, and guys went to work, they're going to be there their whole lifetime. Mm-hmm. And as I say, they absorbed the corporate, almost like Japan, where the corporate culture is so intense.
Yes.
But that's not how you get, you don't, at a certain level, you don't rise vertically through a company. You rise by making horizontal moves to a different company.
Yes.
And I remember I was in Japan once when the head of American Express became suddenly the CEO of IBM. And my Japanese friend said, what does he know about computers? And I said, he doesn't know anything about computers. He knows about running a company. Ha, ha, ha. And you realize if you look at what business schools have taught in the last 15, 20 years, very little of it is dealing with particular subjects. Computers, cars, airplanes, it is financial management. And management really increasingly focuses on the financial side. And again, few people from business schools go into these companies anymore. I mean, they go into the place you can make a lot of money.
Yes.
And one of the reasons why salaries have become so crazy in the industry area is because they have to keep up with people, the salaries in the financial area. So what we're talking about is a dramatic change in corporate culture across all businesses, not just Iran.
I want to quote the author here, and I'll quote what he says is, "What got lost in all this shuffling is a corporate culture that once prized engineering and safety, replaced by one that seemed to be more focused on delivering profits over perfection. The Boeing community in Seattle has been vocal about attributing this slide to the acquisition of McDonnell Douglas, whose leaders took over Boeing's top jobs and reshaped the culture around cost control." This seems to exactly what you've been saying all along, essentially. But I'm surprised that the Boeing people let the McDonnell Douglas take over so, quote unquote, easily.
Well, I don't know if it was easily. I don't know. Again, I don't know the detail. But I've other companies where the takeover was really the takeoveree, and the company which had the tougher people. Again, went in and went through it like a, you know, like locusts through a wheat field. No, that's not surprising. And unfortunately, most of the initial views of takeovers are what? They're not in 5-6 year performance. They are in the first quarter, the second quarter, the third quarter. So that's what happens. And the people who can bump that up, and you can do it by a variety of ways, sometimes very helpful and sometimes very draconian, but that's what has happened. And so that culture ran into the new world of quarterly returns, of financialization. And that's, now, again, there was an assumption by these people that you could have it both ways. Jack Welch certainly didn't think he was running down GE. In the end, he thought he'd have a better company, but also a tighter, he thought, leaner, we heard that again and again, more profit-making company. Squeeze out the fat, squeeze out the parts that aren't working well, da-da-da-da. But so there was an enormous optimism in this movement. No one said, well, we're going to do this just to fuck up these companies. We're going to do it because we think it's going to be better. But looking back, it changes the whole metric. Again, if you think about the hotshot consultancies, these were the consultancies in the 80s, 90s, that took over the chief executive, you know, not the A.T. Kearneys, who looked at how to make a better screw or a better landing gear or something like this. Somehow you could do this at the top and everything would work out better. I mean, remember the Matrix? We used to talk about financial. The dogs, the cats, the cows, I forget what they were on that matrix.
And see, the BCG matrix.
Yes, it all seemed so simple. And yes, BCG is a good example as opposed to A.T. Kearney. I mean, one was down in the trenches making stuff. The other was dreaming. And if you look back, was any of this successful? How much difference did it make anywhere? And that's, I mean, they're wonderful histories to be written. And a couple, there's an anti- I mean, not an anti, but a book about Jack Welch came out about a year ago, which is not very complimentary about this kind of financial management. But it was across the board. And again, when you think of how leveraged aircraft industry it was, the huge amounts of money, to be immune from that is amazing. I mean, that was and Boeing was, you know, also lucky at times. Think of the 747. If Pan Am hadn't bought in to that. I mean, other stories too. If Airbus had been better at the beginning, Boeing might have had more difficulty. And then if McDonnell Douglas had been able to make more DC-9s, they couldn't. I mean, la-di-da, lots of things happen. And so that's, you know.
Lots of things. If Rolls-Royce had made a better engine, maybe Lockheed's 1011 would have been a better competitor. if the DC-10 hadn't had these big crashes, maybe, and so on and so forth.
10-11 would have been better if it didn't have that damn elevator that stewardess is getting trapped in, getting the food up from the lower. I always thought that was wrong. But yeah, those are, we talk about that, the industry coming up. But I think culture in this sense is a residual. It is what happens, what results from longer term changes. And for me, the big change is in the 1980s with the financialization of industry business generally. So the idea of these long-term careers that I grew up in. Remember, I started left college in 60. Guess when I started grade school? Just take a guess. 1944. Can you believe that? But that long-term trajectory from the great firms emerging from the war, people in them. I mean, that's the way life was, and that's the way I grew up. And when my consulting years were in that era, then suddenly in the 1980s, no one wanted, in my own field, as you know, no one wanted to run anything any longer. Why would you want to run a company overseas for 10, 20 years? What you wanted to do is sell things and buy things. You didn't have to run stuff anymore. Mm-hmm. There was enough money around that you could buy and sell things, buy things. And that's where my, as a political risk analyst, that career came to an end because no one wanted to do this stuff. Why would you think of hiring me to tell you what's going to be like in Slovakia in 30 years? Who cared? I want to know what the markets are going to look like tomorrow. And that's why I went back to teaching.
Let's go back to this question. Are all publicly traded companies held to the same standards of growth, margins, and profitability? Meaning that in today's world, that large capital-intensive businesses like Boeing's or its airline customers, for that matter, are being pressured to meet standards that only the GAFAM can produce?
No. I mean, there are companies, family companies that have been very successful. Look in Germany. The German middle-sized firms have been very successful. And there are all sorts of companies in the United States that are family-owned that have withstood all of this. But the big players, and to be a big player now, and you know what? Is that really quite true? I mean, Musk, what the hell is Musk? What kind of a company does he, I mean? So, I mean, what is interesting, the billionaires now in the last couple of years, they run very different kinds of operations. Mm-hmm. The money is new. Mm-hmm. They have so that maybe we're entering a new era. Huge funds, buyout funds. I mean, the big money is to be made here. And that's, aside from maybe there's something new around these few new, the Bezoses, the Zach and so on. But I don't know that anything has gelled out in terms of new. At the moment, we are in this where financial considerations dominate, and the financial community dominates, and it has pervaded and reshaped the culture of most companies. That's what I would say. And we see that from the mid-1980s onward. And now that's a 50-year, it's been a 50-year tour of this world. It certainly, to me, has not benefited anybody. I mean, again, you can relate that to rising inequality, huge amounts of money at the top, weakness of unions, so on and so on and so on. I think are related to all of this, too.
I'm still looking at these companies who have to make these huge cash outlays in order to either just simply exist, example, airlines. But the aerospace manufacturers like Boeing, Airbus, and the like, formerly Bombardier, where I spent 10 years, we used to call it the sporty game, meaning that if we're not successful with this product, we could bankrupt the company. Is it just that investors don't want to invest in these companies anymore? That's too risky?
No, I don't think anything has changed. I mean, this was always risky. I mean, I have here, let me see if I can find it. Here, this is aircraft budgeted cost, actual cost, just very quickly. The 777 budgeted cost $5 billion, actual cost $13 billion. 787 budgeted $5 billion, $32 billion. I mean, none of these, it's a fool's game. to be in this industry, really, financially. And you have to be incredibly lucky, it seems to me. Luckily, yes. But the big yes. thing is there's a good demand. And as long as the regulation was there, then it was easy because everyone had to have enough planes to fly to all these different places. With deregulation, Jesus, I mean, then it's shooting, I mean, shooting crap. I was thinking to myself, how do you know? The 747, in spite of everything, is an enormous success. And the 380 flops. Who knew? So I yes. think this is the only thing that you have is on a few suppliers and a very active ongoing demand. Mm-hmm. And so it's the mm-hmm. demand here that keeps things going. Especially when you have so few suppliers now, and people will put up money, in huge amounts because there is this ongoing demand, and even that the planes don't last forever. I was speaking of in the old days. This was a couple of years ago. If I ever got it on DC-9, mm-hmm. I would tell the stewardess or the cabin, I said, look at this plate. It's older than you are. This plate's older than you are. But you know, none of these have a long lifespan, and there are other things to talk about. They get more expensive. So it's a demand-driven industry with a very, very stable demand. Lots of people flying. So mm-hmm. and it's almost impossible to enter the industry from the outside. God knows, I love Bombardier. I like the people. I like the style. But they couldn't hack it. They made a big mistake trying to go bigger. But, you know, that was but if they didn't, they couldn't be in the game. So, I mean, so think about it.
Damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yeah, a huge demand. Of course, there'll be money. And people throw money at this because there is, when you win, you can win pretty big. Every once in a while, they do win big. But cutting costs has been the other, maintaining quality and engineering quality when you're outsourcing and when you're looking increasingly at cost as related to profit, it's hard to do. I mean, it's not unlike a lot of industries. I mean, that's if you think of railroad, I mean, that's why you have the money available, because you have that huge, solid, continuing demand. You can project that demand. I mean, we'll talk about that, how that demand is going to shape in the future, but it's people do fly around.
My other question, other industries are undergoing forced changes in their culture. For example, the automobile industry is undergoing a tremendous shift from internal combustion engines to batteries and electric motors. How to be successful at these very profound, fundamental changes?
1900, about, I might say 1905, something like that. There are automobiles, they're just beginning. There's electric, there's steam, there's internal combustion. Which one was likely to be the best in terms of safety, in terms of performance, so on and so on? Which one was likely to be the best? Electric, mm-hmm. early electric. Which one won? Internal combustion, because Ford changed the game. Instead of selling cars as an elite, high-priced vehicle, he wanted to sell people's car. And by building the machinery to do that, he was able to reduce the price of the Model T in 3 years from $900 to $300. Mm-hmm. And soon half the cars in the world were Model Ts. I mean, very hard to forecast. I think in the automotive industry, no one knows what's going to happen. I mean, looking forward, you have some Japanese firms saying hybrids. A lot of firms are still saying we can improve the quality of the internal combustion engine. We can make it cleaner. Electrics, yeah, but electrics until you can solve the battery problem, the charging problem, and in any way, in 20 years, are there going to be cars anyway? Or is it all something else? I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know whenever mm-hmm. there has been such a uncertainty. So the culture in the automotive industry has gone to pieces. First of all, Tesla is not one of the players. They don't make cars the same way. They don't live in the same places. They're not mm-hmm. unionized. Mm-hmm. And maybe everything's going to be like that. Or maybe it's not. And so the aircraft industry is much better suited, cited than they are, because flying is up here. We know what that is. And we know there's a demand. And somehow it's going to have wings and motors. I mean, you think of automobiles, you have an idea of what it's going to look like in 10, 20 years. I mean, I have no idea. Telephony.
Yes.
What the hell is that going to be? I mean, the iPhone is a real big world changer. But one can imagine in the next couple of years, you have a chip. I'll be talking a chip under my skin or whatever it's going to be, or a screen up in front of me. It could be anything. I mean, that's the thing that's so interesting. Planes, it's pretty much clear it's not going to be anything. In much of the way, it's not fast trains is not going to replace it. Fancy helicopter. I mean, it's going to be pretty much like it is now. But you have a lot of changes coming. What kind of fuel? Listen to that. What about size of planes? Again, I mean, what's that going to be? How is that going to play out? Are they going to go? And we're talking about supersonic again. Is that really going to? It's hard to believe. And then the other side of this is transport freight. Planes can be made more culturally helpful or less detrimental. You can solve that with electric engines or different kinds of fuel. I mean, a lot more stuff can be sent on in freight. We're just beginning to play that. I mean, one of the interesting things about freight, as you well know, is that the freight airplanes have to land on passenger terminals. There are very few freight airplanes and very few freight routes that aren't so once you separate them entirely and have a freight air system, it could be much, much bigger. But I think that it's not as opaque as in the automotive industry, but there are many, many uncertainties.
Yes.
How much energy do you want to put in your plant on hydrogen, clean hydrogen, if there's such a thing? How much energy do you want to place on? I mean, and then what's coming next anyway? We don't really have much in the pipeline. It's very interesting. The 380, 787.
Are very, very efficient aircraft. I remember being at a conference with Total Energy's chief digital officers stating that probably most biofuels will go to the airline industry anyways, passenger or freight, leaving very little for automotive. But I hear exactly what you said in terms of scenarios being close to 180%, 180 degrees opposite. It's very difficult to look at this. My last question for you on this podcast is this one. In a sector where consolidation is now complete, innovation, financialization, and in uncertainty around climate issues, where do you put your money for growth?
Well, if I could look at changing markets, where is the most what was the most rapidly growing area for aircraft air travel in the past 30 years?
China.
You're right. Where will half of the world's population in the next 50 years will grow, will be in one place? Where?
Africa.
Sub-Saharan Africa.
Yes.
Well, you know, you remember the story that two guys selling shoes go to this poor country. The one calls home and says, "Hey, I'm coming home tomorrow. No one in this country wears shoes." And the other calls, he says, "My God, this is a great place. I'm staying here. No one wears shoes." I don't know. I mean, you got a lot of people. Is that a potential huge market? 30 years ago, no one said that China was a market for anything. Well, I mean, is that a market? I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of places in the world that are underserved. A lot are super served, but there are many that are underserved.
Yes, agreed.
But that also raises what type of plane? You always remember when you guys invented the otter? I mean, you find otters all over the crazy world now. I mean, is there something like that that's going to really neat and efficient that's going to sell in this huge new market? I don't know. But you know, as I know, if you want to go from Lagos to Nairobi, you have to go way of Europe. There's very little going on. you're not old enough to remember Ethiopian Airlines, because if we traveled, we always did that because the stewardesses were so beautiful. It was run by TWA. But I mean, so there's a huge market. There are other places that are under-marketed. So I don't know. And I'm not sure. And the United States is increasingly under-marketed as well, because with deregulation, a lot of firms have stopped going, routes no longer go to a lot of different places. Is there a way, is there something there, lighter, you know, simpler planes? Again, if Bombardier had not tried to go up market, they might, you know, I'm still riding on Bombardiers now when I go to Cleveland. We're still riding those nice 2x2 sweet little planes. I don't know if anyone's making them now.
Mitsubishi is.
Yet they're not selling any yet.
I'm not sure. I think they're still selling some of the longer, the bigger ones, but I'm not sure. I'd have to check.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never flown on one. But I mean, so I think there's no question about this. The question is how the demands of being more climate sensitive, being more fuel sensitive, still making money, can fit into this, because we're by no means overwhelmed. There are lots of places that could use this. I find that all the talk in the United States about fast railroads, you know, crazy, because distances are too long or too short. I mean, the only place we could use it is on the Northeast Corridor, but it's too short because you can't get stop after stop. But, you know, there are lots of other places where modified, shorter range, efficient, you know, planes could be very useful, especially safer, more efficient. You know, I don't know. I don't think it's the end of the line. I think opening new markets, I think that kind of investment in new things is hard for these people to do because it is terribly expensive. And it may be, and you can't really think of startups in this industry because it's so expensive.
There are some, but it's taking time to mature. It's still very experimental, and the safety requirements are so drastic. In my opinion, that's what makes it so expensive.
Well, the flying taxi cab type things are fascinating, but my son-in-law, who's a private pilot for a big wealthy guy, we laugh at 15 planes going up at the same time over Roosevelt. I mean, there's no sense of rules or how that works out. But again, I don't think there's any sight. They're not near the end of the road. But how you get the kind of investment that you need to do that, and whether the two big remaining companies are going to be able to do it, is an interesting question. On the other hand, Musk has done everything else. Why not? You know, he can send rockets to the moon. A little terrifying, the guys. Whoever can do that. What is interesting in this new world is that there are plenty of niches to make money. If you look at our last few years, the big money is not old money. The big money is largely new money. I mean, Zuckerberg was at the 20th anniversary when he was in Harvard. I mean, come on, and it's finding that niche and being able to exploit it. There's no shortage of capital around at the moment, for Christ's sake. I mean, that's it's just a hard industry to break into because you say of regulation and you have the ground stuff and everything. Yes, but I'm probably the only person you work with who flew DC-3s. I have a picture of myself in front of a Ford tri-motor. My mother and me in 1942. We're standing in Pittsburgh Airport to get our Ford tri-motor. I have flown on everything you can possibly imagine over the years.
Professor Blank, as usual, it's a pleasure to hear you and ask you questions. I'll come back and ask you a number of questions, probably on artificial intelligence and where you see that going next time on this podcast.
Well, if you ask me on artificial intelligence, you may not even see me. You'll see my...
alter ego.
Whatever you call it. Yes. It makes me a little scared, everything, and not to be, yes.
Yes.
What can I say? It's a pleasure to see you always.
Thank you.
I think of my days in Paris of just having a ball.
J'espère que cet épisode vous a plu. Comme d'habitude, les réponses ne sont pas nécessairement là où nous les attendons. Donc, la culture prédatrice est souvent celle qui finit par dominer une culture des proies, sauf quand la proie est celle qui achète le prédateur. Une leçon importante pour ceux et celles qui envisagent de faire de la croissance par acquisition dans l'avenir immédiat. Donc, en négociation et en management, attention aux cultures qui n'ont pas peur de la confrontation. Ensuite, l'importance de la demande et la stabilité de celle-ci restent des forces très attractives stratégiquement. Finalement, c'est un peu retour vers le futur pour l'industrie de l'automobile. Peut-être une nouvelle vague de consolidation à prévoir, certainement dans l'industrie chinoise, mais attendons un peu de voir où vont tomber les futures réglementations et les résultats des élections qui sont prévues en 2024, autant en Europe qu'aux États-Unis. Je vous invite à consulter les liens dans la description pour accéder aux notes de l'épisode et pour vous abonner à notre lettre hebdomadaire. Nous y partageons nos perspectives pour vous aider à développer vos compétences stratégiques et vous permettre de développer la croissance de vos organisations. Sur ce, à très bientôt.